Yeah. How do you do, everybody? I'm Tom Gillesberg, chairman of the Schiller Institute in Denmark, and also head of the Copenhagen office of the Executive Intelligence Review. And first I want to thank everybody for coming on such a short notice. And despite it being very close to Christmas and people might have their minds somewhere else, we thought it was important to have this seminar because of the quite dramatic events taking place in the world. Also, especially, I'll get back to that with the terrorist incidents going on in Mumbai, in India, being an attempt to, you could say, throw off the world off its track very shortly before we have the new Obama presidency coming into being in the United States. We had a seminar about 3 months ago on the 11th of September, starting a process which of having seminars, diplomatic seminars, which we unfortunately for some time did not have many of, in order also here in Copenhagen to have a continuous discussion on these most essential matters for all of the world's nations, you can say, on questions of foreign policy, economic policy, strategic policy. On the seminar we had, and I just wanted to say, I think I should introduce, it might be unnecessary, but I'll do it anyway. This you see on the screen is Lyndon LaRouche. He is the founder of the EIR magazine here, which has now been coming out for 35 years and has been labeled by many people the best private intelligence network in the world. It has for many, many years been a key discussion point of an alternative economic and strategic policy to what was presented, and it has been Mr. LaRouche has been running for president, the presidency of the United States for many, many times. Not the last round here. He's now 86 years old, so he thought it's time for somebody younger to become president. But he has been running else he had been running in the presidential election since 1976. And by running as a president in the United States has also been a very key part of the political process and in defining what should be the U.S. policy. As we showed on our last seminar, which those that are interested can go back and listen to, Mr. LaRouche also, in a historic webcast, July 25th, 2007, that is about 1.5 years ago, had a very dramatic prediction, basically laying forth that the international financial system, as we have known it, will begin to disintegrate within the matter of days. And he was very emphatic about this. And as we documented last time, I'm sure everybody is aware, since that time, we've been on a roller coaster ride with the global financial system, but which has been beyond belief of basically almost anybody, of how dramatic it's been going up and down, but way more down than up. And by now has been converted from a financial crisis to become a devastating economic crisis, threatening actually the existence of many nations. We've had a global food crisis, we had an energy crisis. Now we have a full-scale breakdown of the physical economy of many nations around the world, also including, for instance, China, which became the workshop of the world. But right now, it's a workshop where everybody is being laid off. We also, at the last seminar, went through the historical fight Mr. LaRouche has been leading over decades for a new just world economic order, and basically laid forth and said, it's exactly at a time like this, when the present financial system is disintegrating, that the opportunity arises for building something new. And it's exactly at that point where you have to not wait for what is being thrown on the table, but where you have to preempt the discussion by setting forth some fundamental principles on what the new world economic order that is now coming into being, how it should be shaped, how it should be formed. Also at the last seminar, again this is only 3 months ago, this was at the time when the US government began a series of very desperate actions. At that time it was basically with the infusion of huge amounts of funds, you could say the nationalization of the real estate institutions Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, which was a very dramatic thing at the time. And at the time, LaRouche came out very harshly and says that kind of policy of now letting the US government basically bail out these huge financial bubbles that are now collapsing is an insane policy. It can never work. It is an unending process where you will have bailout after bailout after bailout after bailout. And the more you bail out, the bigger the hole you have to cover will be. Therefore, you have to have, he said at the time, this is simply the biggest robbery in the history of man, of basically looting whatever is left, not only of financial resources in the United States, but basically taking a huge amount of private debt from private banks, from private institutions, and transferring it to the US government and other governments. But that, again, despite the huge dimension of this, this cannot work. There's no way, and we'll get back to this several times during the seminar, there is no way that you can bail out the whole speculation bubble and the whole bubble of financial derivatives, which right now have a conservative estimate of $1.4 quadrillion dollars. And that is 1.4 million billion dollars. It's an astronomical amount which by far surpasses the gross national products of the world many, 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 many times over. Exactly. It is totally impossible. It's all based on estimates because nobody knows. I mean, one of the things, we'll get back to that later, of derivatives, is that this is much of it is what they call over-the-counter trading, which means it's not on the books. it's the big elephant in the room nobody talks about because it's so astronomical amounts. But we'll get back to that later. But just for the idea of how insane it is what the U.S. government is doing right now, they have over the year spent about $8 trillion in bailouts, in guarantees to banks, in buying up worthless assets, and so on and so forth, both directly and through the Federal Reserve in the United States. These are huge amounts. I mean, for $8 trillion, you could have a fundamental infrastructure almost anywhere on the planet for that amount. I mean, we're not just speaking about crisscrossing Africa with railroads. This is like you could do so much with these kind of funds. Right now, it's being thrown into an endless hole, which is simply getting bigger and bigger by the day. The latest desperate efforts, as most of you have seen, was that 2 days ago, the Federal Reserve in the United States cut their leading fund rate from 1% to in the area between 0 and 0.25%. Did this help the financial markets? Well, there was a one-day rally of 4% on Wall Street, and then sour times were back. So the important thing of this whole thing has been, the principle has been an insane principle of taking private debts, which cannot really be bailed out to its full dimension, and simply putting it over for the public to take over and supposedly paying off over the next many generations. Already, these policies in the last days have led for the dollar to collapse by 10% in just 4 days. And again, the dollar is the reserve currency of the world. We have a world financial system which is still totally being built up around the US dollar. And if you keep this kind of policy, just one thing, you have all gotten, this is the EIR magazine, and you have all gotten the latest two copies, I'll get back to that. Here we have Helga Sepp LaRouche, the chairwoman and the founder of the Schiller Institute, married to Lyndon LaRouche and a leading political figure in Germany. Now, what this policy, and I'll just, Michelle will go into this much later, but just to paraphrase it, LaRouche has been having this pedagogical presentation of what this actually means, this triple curve, that you have three different economic processes that's been ongoing at the same time. The downward curve collapsing is the physical economy. This is infrastructure investments, this is hospitals, schools, physical production of all sorts. That has been collapsing in most parts of the world severely over the last couple of decades. Then you have the monetary aggregates, the one above, money printing. Huh?
So if the production is going down, so how, and the number of people on the board is going up, so how can all these people survive?
Well, we'll get back in that to details later. Basically, you could say this has been the process of globalization, which means that you have been shutting down production in the United States, in Western Europe, and then you have been transferring it, for instance, to China, to other places. But at the same time, the process you have had has been that the reinvestments needed to have long-term physical production and to support the physical economies of different nations have not been made. That is sewer system, water system, electricity system. If you go to the United States, you'll notice that there's electricity crisis, there's water crisis, there's no trains running basically anymore, the roads are not being prepared, the bridges fall apart. This is all the physical economy disintegrating, whereas the money print press have been rolling. Money has been produced in huge amounts. And on top of that, you have the financial aggregates being increasing even more. And that is speculation of all sorts. This is financial derivatives. Basically, money being created out of money. Now, what we are seeing right now with this bailout, I mean, now the financial bubble is collapsing. But in order to prevent the collapse, the money presses is being put into high gear to pump out money to keep the financial bubble afloat. So you can see suddenly the money increases, the monetary aggregate increases faster than the financial bubble. And that leads you into a situation where this is from Weimar, Germany, where the value of currency very quickly can evaporate. So we are right now having a situation where on the one side we have a global economic depression taking hold, where you have a deflation due to economic depression. At the same time, you have an uncontrolled amount of money being printed, which leads to hyperinflation. Now, at the same time of this, Michelle will go into depth into this, what you can say, therefore, what LaRouche has proposed as a solution to this. How do you solve this crisis? What is the problem with the present model? What can be done instead? That will be the second part of the seminar. The other important aspect right now, which I will get into quite a lot, is that this global financial crisis also means the end of the dominance of what you can say the extended global British Empire policy, which is not something primarily based on, when we say a British Empire, on people being British or not British, but which is a global financial empire basically run out of City of London, which is all based on private banking control, and which, as you probably have noticed over the last couple of decades, have vastly increased its power. That is, that over the last two decades, we've seen a transfer of power away from sovereign nation states over to private financial interests. Most immediately controlled out of London, but with Wall Street and the financial banks and so on and so forth in the United States, the financial entities, as an extension of this City of London private banking phenomenon. Now, what is so dramatic right now is that in the crisis we are right now, this private banking system can no longer function. Because these private banks can circulate credit that has been created somewhere else. They can take money in and give it back out. But they cannot really create real physical, real money backed up by the physical economy. Only nation states can really do that. So the big question coming up is, well, what will happen now? Will this global extended British Empire model, called also globalization these days, will this collapse? Will this disappear and be replaced by sovereign nation states collaborating and building up the world physical economy? Or will we simply see the present system disintegrate and be replaced by chaos, war, and private interests, so to speak, doing their little thing? And as part of this, and therefore I think especially right now in the aftermath of the Mumbai terror incident, I will therefore also give an example of how this terror is actually run as a strategic policy out of London to try to control the world in this very critical phase.
So do you think that the London terrorist attacks were made by London itself?
We'll get back to that. I'll present that in detail.
Okay.
So, yes, I mean, basically what we saw in Mumbai, as I will show, and what we have presented in the two issues of EIR you have all received, is basically a documentation that this terror attack in Mumbai were designed to look like it came from Pakistan. There was Pakistani intelligence services involved, there was Pakistani involved. But the design of it and the print of it is from something called Londonistan among friends. That is London, which for a long time has been the basic home to most terrorist networks in the world. I'll get back to that. This is a very well documented phenomenon. And of course it was designed with this attack to basically induce India to go to war against Pakistan. That was the setup. Luckily that has not happened up until now, and by fortune you could say, Lyndon LaRouche had already, and his wife Helgaset LaRouche had already pre-planned a trip to India before this terrorist incident took place, not to Mumbai but to New Delhi, where LaRouche spent 10 days leading with a lot of private meetings, also important strategic institutions, security institutions, military-related institutions, to discuss what is really going on here, which I think had a very a very important effect in the present situation. LaRouche, despite the fact that he's 86 years old, is a very active man, because barely had he returned to the United States from India and also to intervene very actively in the shaping of the presidency, of the Obama presidency in the United States, when he also yesterday came to Strasbourg, to the European Parliament, and yesterday gave was invited by a number of members of European Parliaments, mainly from also a group of people from Italy, the Forza Italia group, the conservative group United Europe of Nations, members of Liga North, other socialist members of the European Parliament. So this was not one, this was both from what you would say the more left wing and the more right wing of the parliament. This was like a very mixed grouping. And he gave yesterday half an hour press conference in Strasbourg in the European Parliament on key issues also confronting us here today. And since he did that, I will actually, we have distributed his the first draft of his comments, but I will also take very basically paraphrase what he said there, since this is exactly the topic of our discussion today. Now, in about a little more than 1 month, Obama is to take the oath to become president of the United States. Now, normally 1 month is not that long a time, but under the present circumstances, it is a very, very long time. A lot of things can happen within 1 month. I mean, on top of all things, as you will see as I go through why this is a very relevant point, Mr. LaRouche has several times been warning about the danger of the British intelligence services using their terrorist capability to actually assassinate Obama before he becomes president. Such an assassination would throw the United States and the world into chaos. Now, we already have seen, we saw the terrorist attacks in Mumbai, and this is typical of what can be expected in this period in order to overthrow the normal order of things. Now, pending all that, when Obama is coming into office, he is faced with a dramatic crisis. The crisis that LaRouche forecasted last year, the biggest crisis in all of modern history. It's a crisis of financial derivatives, as I said, in the quadrillions of dollars in debt. The good news is that despite the fact that British agents such as George Soros were instrumental in securing the presidency for Obama, that is, in defeating Hillary Clinton, who the British hate very, very much, despite that, then the appointments of Obama is not Soros people. It is not the people London would prefer. The most extreme case, of course, is Hillary Clinton, which is one of the persons which Lyndon LaRouche would say, this is my among my circles of friends and collaborators. But we also see it with other appointments, like the new Attorney General of the United States, Holder, who is a very anti-drugs man, totally against the Soros policy of getting everybody on drugs. You also see it in the security appointments. You see it in the appointments of Gates to defense minister. The present defense minister will stay on, a very capable and competent person who, if it had not been sabotaged by Dick Cheney, would actually have been engaged in the process of actually giving United States a way out of the mess in Iraq. Yes?
Yeah, Sir, the way I see it so far in the presentation is that we are facing a huge conspiracy theory that would actually have for one goal to totally destroy the Western system, which I don't think that this is we have many ingredients to this, while we are a little bit getting away from what we are supposed to be discussing here today concerning the economic and Obama. And the way you are describing it makes it a little bit unrealistic that all these factors that will only contribute to the destruction of the Western system are supposedly done to preserve the game, whatever it may be, which is quite impossible. It's not that I'm rejecting everything in theory, but at the same time, I cannot just accept it the way you did, because it doesn't look real.
Well, don't. What we do is this, because the idea basically and the format that we decided to have is that I'll give a presentation which we also record so we can use it for public use. And then we'll turn off the microphone, so to speak, and have a more blunt discussion afterwards. So write down all the disagreement and points and let's take them afterwards so we don't have to go over the same thing back and forth but can get a coherent picture. Now, Obama will be confronting this very dramatic crisis, and basically there is a plan A and a plan B how to deal with this. Plan A is what we will present, which is LaRouche's policy of how to do this, how that Obama can play the role of a Franklin D. Roosevelt, of actually reorganize the system as a credit system, generate credits for economic development. It's a totally different policy than this policy of going to zero interest rates and so on and so forth that we see right now, which is creating an incalculable situation. It means that we end the system of that has been going on since 1971-72 period, that we go back to a fixed exchange rate system, a credit system, the American style, credit made by the U.S. government, which then can be monetized and you can do all kinds of things with it internationally. There's provisions for this in the U.S. constitutions. This was what Franklin D. Roosevelt had intended for the Bretton Woods system to be after World War II. And if the United States has this kind of credit generation policy, then you would have the credits to have also long-term agreements between the United States and other nations. You get the credits for long-term investments in physical infrastructure. You can't save the whole financial derivative bubble. That has to go. That has to be written off. But if you go back to the nation state, to long-term commitments, agreements for a quarter century, half a century, sometimes a century on these infrastructure development projects, you can get a way out. And what LaRouche proposes is that the United States, with Obama as president, basically initiate a new Bretton Woods system together with, reaches out to Russia, to China, to India, and thereby involves all of Eurasia where you have the greatest poverty and need for development. I mean, LaRouche was just in India. 63% of the population is in extreme poverty. A huge amount of the population in China is in extreme poverty. I mean, so with this four-power block, you have within it not only the United States, you also have these countries which is in dire need of real in-depth economic development. Also with Russia, you have huge amount of the potential available strategic raw materials of the world. But these raw materials are not easily accessible. They are in the subarctic region, where you have to use very advanced levels of modern technology to actually get access to these raw materials. within such a conception of what the world is, and if these four nations would initiate such a that you would have such a four power agreement between these four big powerful nations, then of course many other nations would jump in. Japan, Korea, Asian nations, South American nation, I'm sure African nations would stand in line to join, and even of course Europe would see it's as its very essential interest to actually join into this. And thereby Europe and the United States again could get a key role in providing science and technology for this kind of global development. Now, what LaRouche predicts is there will be problems and complications, of course, in the Obama administration. This is not it does not consist of all the people we would have appointed if we had to choose. But getting 50 to 60% of what you want, that's pretty good these days. The problem is, of course, that most people in the economic profession did not see this global economic crisis come. And therefore, they have absolutely no idea of what to do. That is, when you as a politician ask the economic experts, where did this crisis come from and where do we go from here? You are in most cases left with some very incompetent economic advisors. That is therefore the key role of LaRouche, which has not only been predicted this for a long time, also as I said very explicitly before it turned acute, but also has presented the idea which Michel will go through later of how do we step by step get out of this mess. Now LaRouche says this is the good news, this is plan A. Of course, there's no guarantee you will get a plan A. You will get this kind of orderly, sane solution to this. You might have to have in your drawers a plan B, which will be a disorganized disintegration of the global financial system, where you'll see a collapse of global civilization, which are potentially much more dire than what we saw with the collapse of European civilization in the 14th century, with the Dark Age and all of these terrible things where somewhere between half, one-third and one-half of Europe's population at the time disappeared. Now, the big difference, of course, also being when you had these Dark Ages in Europe, this was not a global extended crisis. Today we have a global financial system where no part of the world is not incorporated in it. This is all continents, maybe with the exception of Antarctica, that is hit by this thing. Which again is both a very, very threatening thing and a very, very scary thing, but which also of course means that if we deal with this crisis in the right way, this is literally the whole world that are in the same boat. And if we salvage the boat and the people being in it, this will totally open up a new era for all mankind. And if we do it the right way, which Michel later will go through, this means going back to sovereign nation states. It means that a lot of the countries which have suffered severely over the last couple of decades in Africa, in South America, parts of Asia, which has basically been assigned to die, they will have an opportunity to actually have a very bright future. Now that's the one part of the matter. What I will do also is going through this other quite controversial issue, which is this question of British directed terror, chaos and war. And which is a very, very controversial thing. Because most people, including our own government here in Denmark, will say, but Britain is our ally. If you talk to circles in the US, they'll say, but Britain is our best ally. And so will many nations around the world. They say, but the British are always there as a good friend. When we don't know what to do, they have many good ideas. They're always there. You could say, the British are as good and reliable a friend as Iago was to Othello in Shakespeare's famous play Othello. And I would recommend everybody over Christmas to read this play. Maybe watch Verdi's opera of it. Because what Shakespeare presented is this character Iago, which pretending to be the friend of everybody, and again this is taking place in a Venetian colony, very important. This is the Venetian principle, but which is very, very much in active in London these days, as the, you could say, London took over the role of Venice. And Iago, being the friend of everybody, induces everybody to ruin themselves. This is exactly what has for quite some time has been the very active foreign policy role of Britain, being the friend with everybody, but at the same time doing everything they can through whispering in the ear to induce the doom on everybody, including, for instance, such things as getting India and Pakistan to go into war against each other. What interest would India and Pakistan have in this? None. Or the case with terrorism, because as you know, Britain officially has been one of the leading powers of coming out saying, we have to fight terrorism, we have to fight terrorism. It was actually Tony Blair which got the United States to go into Afghanistan and Iraq. He gave the solid proof of weapons of mass destruction in Iraq and so on and so forth. At the same time, when you look at the things, you see, as I said, Londonistan being the key player in global terrorism. And you have had this effect for the last decades of, you could say, Great Britain being like they would say that the world has been run by British brains and American brawn, American muscle. And this has most emphatically been the case in the last more than seven years of the Bush-Cheney administration. Now, and this again is why the British did not want Hillary Clinton, because Hillary Clinton, and especially also through Bill Clinton, and through the good advice of Lyndon LaRouche, has actually an understanding of this. And this is why it was the key role of having George Soros going in, and the hope for was George Soros, which is a total British agent, having George Soros being a controller of the Obama administration, which has fortunately, up until now, not been been working out. Now, if we look at what happens in the Mumbai terrorist events, as already came out of a couple of days after the terrorist attack came out, was the fact that among the people found in this being involved in the terrorist activities were a number of people with British passports. This is not as this was to be expected. And what this, when you investigate this whole incident, it points to implicate networks in Pakistan, but again point to Britain, point to Londonistan, point to the international terrorist network, which is supported very much out of London through Great Britain, but also through Saudi charities, Saudi Arabia being a key financial sponsor of these international networks. This involved MI6 controlled networks in Pakistan in the inter-service intelligence and its fronts such as Laskar-e-Taiba and Jaish-e-Mohammed, which were found to be behind the Mumbai attacks. If you read in the magazines you've all received, there's an article by Jeff Steinberg called "Shut Down the Anglo Saudi Global Terrorist Apparatus Behind Mumbai Attack," basically going through this, going through how you have people like Dawood Ibrahim, who gave key logistical support to the attack in Mumbai. And Dawood Ibrahim could do this because he's a very key figure in international organized crimes, in gold and opium smuggling. He has been very key in controlling the underground in Mumbai, and his operatives were key in carrying out this attack. Now, of course, he's working out of Karachi, Pakistan, and out of Dubai. He is known for being linked to major terrorist incidents. Let's take it in the question period, because you'll have more to comment on, I'm sure. In 1999 and 2001, he was linked to major terrorist incidents. There was a hijacking of an Air India plane in 1999. There was a brutal assault in the Indian Parliament in 2001. And since 2003, he has been on the State Department list of international terrorists for his links to Al-Qaeda and Lashkar-e-Taiba. And he is also linked to Ahmed Omar Sheikh, who is a very interesting character. He is a British MI6 agent for all that we know, who graduated also came from London School of Economics, and then got engaged in all of these terrorist activities. He was freed as part of this 1999 hijacking of Air India plane, and at that time giving free passage to England. He had been convicted in India for kidnapping 4 British and an American citizen. As I said, he was from London School of Economics, recruited to MI6, active in Bosnia, then Afghanistan, trained in Afghanistan, this kidnapping in India. Presently, he's in custody in Pakistan. As far as we know, he's actually still alive, but waiting to be hanged for the murder of the Wall Street Journal journalist Richard Pearl, who, by the way, was engaged in exposing all of these networks. Let's take it later. Let's take it in the discussion period.
Daniel Pearl, yeah.
Oh, sorry. Daniel Pearl, yes. And he is also a prime suspect for involvement in the September 11th terrorist attack in the United States in 2001. Now the point is, of course, with all of these kind of things, India has many times over complained to Britain about the fact that you had terrorists, openly acknowledged terrorists, operating out of London. Why do London not do something about this? But to no avail. And actually, as we document in our material, then India is not alone. Egypt, Israel, France, Algeria, Peru, Turkey, Germany, Libya, Nigeria, Yemen, and Russia is among nations which has complained to Britain over the fact that Britain is housing terrorists that is operating against these nations. Now, this is a very big story. This is very dramatic. Therefore, I will not even try to get into all of the details with it, but there is, as I said, a very documentation of it in the EIR magazine given to you. You can read all about it in the EIR. And what you don't read now will come in coming issues, because this is an evolving story. When LaRouche and his wife came to India, of course, part of this, of them coming there, it was very nice that as they arrived, they could hand over to the Indian authorities a memorandum from Executive Intelligence Review made already January 11th, the year 2000, to the American Foreign Minister at the time, Madeleine Albright, basically asking her and asking the United States to put Great Britain on the list of nations lending support to international terrorist organizations. And this was not done lightly. There's some very specific 7-point criteria you have to fulfill in order to be such a terrible rogue state doing these kind of things. But if you go through every one of them, London has definitely lived up to a position on such a list. Now, again, I think this is very, very, very important to take up, because we are in a very dangerous situation. But we are also in a very hopeful situation. There is the possibility, and I must say, over the last couple of months, we've seen the potential of the Obama presidency grow dramatically. By Obama appointing, well, a rotten apple here and here, like his chief of staff, Rahm Emanuel, is not exactly what we would call a qualified candidate. He comes out of the Chicago, not so clean scene, and he is very tied into certain financial interests and so on. But there's also a lot of people that are very capable and who are very committed to the idea of restoring the United States image around the world. Of after this terrible nightmare that has gone on under Cheney and Bush, where the standing of the United States really has been demolished to a degree, and this is not a big secret, this is openly discussed in the United States to a degree that you have never seen before in U.S. history. The Obama presidency seemingly is committed to restoring a credible U.S. position around the world, restoring collaboration between the United States and other sovereign nation states around the world. And us coming into these very, very dramatic times, there is therefore, as we see it, a real potential of actually getting the United States to doing what would, for many people, seem to be the unthinkable, of returning to the legacy of Franklin D. Roosevelt, of returning to the policy of the United States not seeing itself as an ally of Great Britain and being a partner in crime, you could say, keeping the British informal empire in place, but on the contrary, going back like Roosevelt did to the tradition of going up against the British Empire. Of actually, again, the United States was built not to be part of the British system, but to break the empire system. United States was once a subdued colony which the British had intended should live in slavery forever, and they said no. And with this kind of outlook of the United States, all of the nations of the world will actually have the opportunity of getting something they have been very hungry for a long time. That is a true friend in economic development, in actually have functioning nation states. But at the same time, and this it's an extremely critical thing, that in the rest of the world, other governments is actually reaching out to the United States, aware of this fight, aware of the British problem. And I say now I mentioned the British, but of course other nations that might have colonial ambitions are no better. It's the same tradition. Of other nations reaching out to the United States and says, no, let's go with a real new Bretton Woods. Because as Michel will show you, again, immediately at the time when people, political leaders like Sarkozy in France, like Tremonti, the economics minister in Italy, began to speak of the necessity of a new Bretton Woods. And Sarkozy forced through the G20 summit in Washington. Then immediately you saw Gordon Brown, the friend of everybody, coming out saying, oh, I'm also for a new Bretton Woods, but presenting something diametrically opposed to what LaRouche has been putting forward the last many years. So I think I've raised quite a few controversial topics. I think I'll end my presentation here and leave this very exciting presentation of how do you actually get this kind of global economic development policy going with LaRouche's policy. This Michel will go into after the break. For now, I will turn off the microphone here, and so we can have what they call a frank discussion.